From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Mountain View.
San Rafael.
Lower Haight, San Francisco.
Brentwood.
Corte Madera.
Pleasant Hill.
Inner Richmond in San Francisco.
Montclair in Oakland.
Coming up, challenging ideas about who is and who is not outdoorsy.
People tell me all the time, well, black people don't have a relationship with wild spaces. But when I start talking about fishing, for instance, ears perk up and the stories unfold.
Then a park ranger tells the story of African Americans in nature by playing a buffalo soldier.
There are places in this world that are so beautiful that they grab hold of you.
And we'll come face to face with a real life Rosie the Riveter.
And that's the story that I relate to, because I'm one of those extraordinary, ordinary people.
Our national parks and the people who use them, today on Cross Currents. This month marks the centennial of our national park system. So today on the show, we're celebrating. And parks are a big, big part of life here in the Bay Area, from the Point Reyes National Seashore to the Port Chicago Naval Magazine in Concord, Alcatraz, Fort Point, the Presidio, Muir Woods. There's a wealth of natural beauty and heritage, but for some reason, not everyone is benefiting. Last month, New America Media commissioned a nationwide survey of 900 African American, Asian, and Hispanic voters. It asked them how often they visit our national public lands. Turns out, nearly half had never been to a national park. Reporter Todd Whitney decided to take a closer look at the perception that black folks like him aren't really into nature.
Dang, there's a mountain of statistics that say black Americans don't go out in nature as much as other ethnicities. I mean, it's something that I can believe because I kind of live it and I fit into the statistic. I'm black and I kind of like nature, but I don't really mess with it in a traditional sense. And I know I'm not alone in that. I'm here in Joaquin Miller Park in Oakland, California with Rue Mapp, the founder and CEO of Outdoor Afro.
Outdoor Afro is an online and in-person social and nature network. And it's our goal to celebrate and inspire African American connections to nature.
I took a hike with Rue and other hikers on a Sunday morning, and I asked them about what they think of black folks and nature not mingling much.
I think a lot of times, a lot of black people, like for me, we're originally from Chicago and we lived in a very concentrated area, cement city really. So in the city, we just knew city life and city stuff, but we didn't know like outdoorsy stuff. But once you move away from the environment, then you can do outdoorsy stuff.
That's Kush Anderson. She and her son Jermaine traveled from Sacramento to participate in today's hike. Then there was Krishna Jude Moore. So I asked Jude Moore if he was familiar with any black American contributions to the environmental movement.
It was a black man who came up with peanut butter, and everybody I know who goes camping, I mean, you got to have peanut butter.
Moore's talking about George Washington Carver, and he's not just the inventor of peanut butter, but he's one of the most prominent agriculturalists and inventors of the 1800s. These contributions that we tend to forget about are what Rue Mapp thinks is part of a rich history of outdoor exploration and environmentalism that black Americans have been part of. Our group leader, Rue Mapp, breaks it down for us.
Much of our history there, and so that one of the things that Outdoor Afro aims to do is to break open not only the natural history of a place, but the human history of a place. And in that way, we're able to help people feel a deeper sense of connection, purpose, as well as a sense of ownership. Like, this is mine, you know, these are where my people dwelt.
History is a big part of these walks for Rue Mapp. She told me about the Buffalo Soldiers. The Buffalo Soldiers, they were an all-black military unit that later became some of America's first park rangers. But the black tradition of outdoor contributions goes beyond the Buffalo Soldiers. There's also individuals like John Francis. He's a black man who grew up in Marin County, and he walked across America to promote environmentalism back in the 70s. To learn more about some of these black environmentalists, I met up with Carolyn Finney. She's the author of Black Faces, White Spaces. And she's a professor of environmental policy and management at UC Berkeley.
In terms of the majority culture, historically in the United States, setting a narrative and a tone about the environment and the way we should think about it and relate to it, we black and brown folks have largely been left out of that mainstream conversation.
So Finney says being left out takes a couple different forms. One of those is representation in environmental and government organizations, where people of color represent somewhere between 12% and 16%, while we make up nearly 40% of the U.S. population. Then there's the media's representation of black folks in nature. Dr. Finney looked into this. She picked up a decade's worth of issues of Outside Magazine. That's one of the most popular outdoor enthusiast magazines around. In it, of the 4,600 photos that had people in them, just over 100 featured black Americans. And those are mostly famous male athletes. Doing my own little experiment, I checked out the latest edition of Outside Magazine.
Nah. Hey, there's a familiar face. There's a brother right there. There's one. Nah.
In the latest edition of Outside, out of the 87 photos that have people in them, only 8 feature black Americans. But representation isn't just about jobs and the images in magazines. It's about the larger narrative we create about the environment and the outdoors. Black people do get outside, just not in the traditional ways that we tend to think about the outdoors. Some people get their outdoor activities by hitting a hiking trail, while others might just kick it over to Lake Merritt for a barbecue. It all doesn't have to look the same. Again, here's Rue Mapp from Outdoor Afro.
People tell me all the time, well, black people don't have a relationship with wild spaces. But when I start talking about fishing, for instance, ears perk up and the stories unfold.
Some of those stories are part of a history when coming together in public spaces wasn't always safe for black folks. And that legacy of not having safety in numbers has led to a particular way of thinking about nature. When the Outdoor Foundation surveyed Americans and asked why they don't take advantage of nature, more than a third of black Americans said they're just not interested.
Nature has a PR problem. For generations, people have worked really hard on farms. The idea of going out and sleeping on the ground is not appealing. It doesn't signal progress to some people. I've actually have heard some people say, why are you going to play homeless?
Well, in my experience on the hike, with the birds, the smells, the views, the tranquility, it felt really good to be outdoors. I might even start to switch my walks around Lake Merritt in Oakland for more hikes in the hills. In Oakland, I'm Todd Whitney for Cross Currents.
That story first aired in 2014. Well, last week, our friends at New America Media hosted a panel to discuss how to increase those low numbers of people of color visiting national public lands. On that panel was Rue Mapp, founder of Outdoor Afro. We just heard from her in that last story.
In our country, we are experiencing rapid demographic change. By 2043, we will have a majority in this country who are people of color. So it is imperative that people of diverse backgrounds see themselves as represented and engaged in our parks and public lands, not only for their own individual and community health and well-being, but also to ensure that those places that we hold dear, those parks and public lands that we expect to be around forever, actually have stewards.
Kay Wang, who works with the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, said for some communities, there's also an issue of trust.
They look at us coming in the uniform. There's a fear, there's a gap, especially when you go into the Lapino community. We actually, the outfit, the color, almost look like people from the immigration office. So there's a really strange but very real barrier we need to break, right?
Researcher Anthony Williams was also there. He said, sure, it's important to try to staff parks with more people of color, but we also need to create programs that appeal to broader audiences. Then the work of reaching out can come from a real place.
That outreach is critical because you have people who I think are predisposed to have an interest in outdoor activities that don't have information, don't have any family history of going to national public lands. They need to be touched the first time.
So a number of organizations joined this movement and formed the Next 100 Coalition. They want to help design a more inclusive approach so that over the next 100 years, the Park Service is more reflective of all people in the country. There's more information about the next 100 at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Earlier in the show, we heard about Buffalo Soldiers. We're going to hear more about them now from Park Ranger Shelton Johnson.
When I first started telling the story, most people, or many people, had never heard of this contribution. And whenever you tell a story that no one's ever heard before, one of the initial reactions is disbelief. And sometimes people can even feel that it's not true, that it's actually an out-and-out lie.
Shelton Johnson brings this hidden history to life through a storytelling project at Yosemite National Park. We're going to listen now as he channels that past and transforms into the fictional role of Buffalo Soldier Alize Bowman. KALW's Leela Day produced this story, and a note to our listeners, this story contains some racially charged language.
This is Sergeant Bowman. How you doing? Now, I got a question for you. Do you remember the first time you ever saw the stars? Now, I don't know who you are out there listening to me. I don't know if we ever gonna meet. But for everyone out there, there's always that first time you see the stars. And you feel them as much as you see them in the darkness of the night.
My name is Shelton Johnson, and I work in the Division of Interpretation and Education right here in Yosemite National Park. I would say that my job is to facilitate astonishment.
Nowhere have I seen country like this before. The sort of place that gets into your bones, it gets into your blood, and pretty soon you think there's no place else in the world but Yosemite. Because when you're here, there ain't no other place in the world. It just grabs hold of your eyes.
I grew up right in inner city Detroit in the 60s and 70s. My family didn't visit national parks. There were local city parks and county parks, but national parks were not part of my childhood. So it was something that was really pretty foreign to me culturally.
It grabs hold of your ears, and all you can hear is Yosemite. That's what happens when you're here too long. It's like getting too much whiskey. You just don't see right and you don't hear right. You don't feel anything but where you are. Guess that means I'm a local now. Guess that means I become part of this country.
This program that I do at the park, it tells people or informs people about the Buffalo Soldier history in Yosemite and Sequoia National Park, and the greater history of Buffalo Soldiers who served in the Great Plains during the Indian Wars.
It took me joining the Army, the U.S. Army, becoming a cavalryman, that led me on a path that took me to a place, to an experience I didn't think I'd ever have. I didn't even know it was there.
When people ask me, well, who are the Buffalo Soldiers? My response is that the Buffalo Soldiers were African-American cavalry and infantry troops that were formed in 1866, and they served during the Indian Wars, which is how they came by the name Buffalo Soldiers. They were given that name by their Plains Indian antagonists, primarily because the texture of their hair resembled the matted cushion between the horns of the buffalo.
There are these Indians that we were after, and I gotta admit, they were after us as well. And some of them got a few of us, and few of us got some of them. That's how it works in war. And you're always kind of uneasy when you know there are people out there that you can't see, that you don't know, that are trying to kill you.
If it's the Indian Wars, then you're following orders. And of course, if you don't follow orders in the military, that's insubordination. That can lead to court-martial.
Growing up in South Carolina, growing up in Spartanburg, I got a lot of names that were called me. I've been called nigger. I've been called worse than nigger. But to think that someone gave me and my men, my troop,
my regimen, a name that was based on something sacred to them, dear to those people, to that culture. I just can't wrap my mind around that I have received a compliment from the people we are trying to kill, to remove, to exclude, to annihilate. That's a word Lieutenant taught me, annihilate. Me ain't nothing left.
I first became a National Park Ranger in 1987 in Yellowstone National Park. I just kind of fell in love with the mission, the whole idea of protecting one of the most celebrated places on the planet. It just appealed to me. I think there's a perception within our culture that African Americans have had very little to do with national parks or with wilderness, primarily because of popular culture. And even within African American culture, again, those memories seem to have been lost, and African Americans, up to a certain point, didn't talk about African American soldiers serving in national parks. So it was forgotten outside the culture, and it was forgotten within the culture, because we've all grown up with Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone. We've grown up with Westerns where African Americans appear little. They're not there. They're just not there at all.
You're a fool, Boone. Those are slaves, not people. They don't feel about things the way you would.
With African Americans, it's history. It's almost everything is rooted in the past. Everything is rooted in history. And I always put it that if you really want to understand today, you have to look at yesterday. So in order for us to really think about why African Americans look at nature and look at mountains in a certain way, we have to look at the African American past in the United States. And that's where the answer, that's where you can find the answer.
There are places in this world that are so beautiful that they grab hold of you, and there's a bit of you, there's a piece of who you are, of your soul, that gets taken away, that gets taken. And the earth don't give it back. It just holds on to it.
Park Ranger Shelton Johnson playing the role of a buffalo soldier. He works at Yosemite National Park. That piece was produced by KLW's Lila Day. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Our last story today is about a national historic park that's a little closer to home. It's called the Rosie the Riveter World War II Home Front, and it's right on the water in the city of Richmond. During World War II, people from around the country came to work in Bay Area shipyards.
We are still short millions of hands. We must call upon women. Women are called upon to leave their homes and take jobs.
For the first time, women were allowed to work in high-paying jobs previously only done by men. At the height of the war, women made up more than a quarter of the Richmond shipyard's workforce. Rosie the Riveter is the icon we remember to celebrate these women. But according to Betty Soskin, who worked in Richmond at the time, the story of Rosie the Riveter...
That was a white woman's story. I was an African-American woman, colored in those days.
Betty told another side of this story to reporter Callie Shanafelt in this segment from our archives.
Betty Reed Soskin was 4 years old when she moved to the East Bay. She grew up there in a Creole and Cajun community from New Orleans. She got married in 1942, soon after the United States entered World War II. Soskin says the Bay Area quickly became a hub of wartime shipbuilding.
It took seven people to support everyone on the front.
And workers were in demand. But there was a hierarchy, Soskin says. First hired at the Richmond shipyards were men who were too old to fight, and boys who were too young to go, then single white women, then married white women.
Then black men to support the Rosies, do the heavy lifting. Eventually, black women, but that wasn't until 1944, though there were some exceptions.
So Soskin says when she was looking for work as a 21-year-old African-American woman in 1942, her options were limited.
I was seen as only fit to be a domestic servant or to work in agriculture, which means picking cotton.
In fact, Henry Kaiser recruited workers for the shipyards from cotton-growing southern states, such as Mississippi, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas.
And he brought to the Bay Area the entire system of segregation as it existed in the South. He brought black and white people together. These were largely sharecroppers of both races, who would not be sharing either drinking fountains or schools or hospitals or public accommodations or even cemeteries for another 20 years back in their places of origin.
Prior to this great migration, Soskin says racial discrimination in the Bay Area was more subtle than Jim Crow segregation. So when people came from the South, they shook up the racial dynamics of Richmond.
White people, even at that level, that economic level, expecting a continuation of white privilege. Black people expecting a better deal.
And while many African Americans did find a better life in the Bay, Soskin says they didn't exactly find an equitable one. Black workers weren't allowed into the shipyard's Boilermaker Union. So in 1943, they established the auxiliary, A36, for black workers. That union hired Betty Soskin to work in the administration office.
All those people who worked out of our union hall had helper or trainee on their union cards. That would mean that they would not be in competition with white workers after the war ended.
But having a union card, even as a helper or trainee, usually meant better wages. And while Soskin never saw a ship, other black women fought to get jobs as welders or burners in the shipyard. Margaret Archie, who followed her husband to the shipyards from Texas, was one of those women.
Mostly, they wanted women to sweep. And my husband said, no, you ain't gonna sweep. I said, you swept all your life. So you gonna wail.
So Archie's husband went down to the union hall.
You had to know somebody that was in the union to get you in.
The person her husband knew charged them $20 to admit Archie into the union so she could become a welder. She says it was a rare accomplishment for a black woman in the 40s.
All the day long, whether rain or shine, she's a part of the assembly line. She's making history, working for victory, Rosie the Riveter.
By the end of the war, Archie and her co-workers had built 747 ships in 4 years and 8 months. Betty Soskin.
This was an amazing undertaking by extraordinary, ordinary people, and that's the story that I relate to, because I'm one of those extraordinary, ordinary people.
Now, at 88 years old, Soskin has had time to process her role on the home front during World War II. Despite the great social changes of that time, she still remembers the pain of the discrimination she faced as a black woman.
We were forced to hire men too old to fight and boys too young to go. Women out of their homes, disrupting the entire American mystique of what it means to be a man or a woman in order to gear up for that great mobilization. Even at that time, we were willing to sacrifice on the altar of racial segregation human potential of a huge, huge percentage of people based upon color.
But Soskin worries that we haven't learned from this history. She fears we still hold people back because of race, class, and gender.
I am concerned that as an American, there are still practices that are sacrificing African Americans, Latinos, that are crippling the country. I think that's a tragedy, and maybe that's the lesson of the mobilization that I take away.
And now she has a platform to share those lessons.
Rosie, Rosie, Rosie the Riveter on the assembly line.
In Richmond, I'm Callie Schanefeldt for Cross Currents.
That story originally aired in 2010. Betty Soskin still works at the Rosie the Riveter National Historic Park. At 94 years old, she's the oldest park ranger in the country. And that's our show today. Our team includes Nicole Grigg, Angela Johnston, Jürgen Klemm, Lisa Morehouse, James Rowlands, Stephen Short, Judy Silber, and Andrew Stelzer. The show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Julie Kane is our managing producer. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This classical harp is by the Destiny Muhammad Jazz Trio. They've got a free show on Thursday at Yerba Buena Gardens in San Francisco, and the show starts at 12:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.